Hi, everybody. My name is Alyssa Gershowitz. I work for the Hornbook Magazine. We review children's books and write articles about children's literature. We interview authors. We publish newsletters. We really like children's books. This panel is about adventure stories, as you know. And these four authors show that adventures can happen anywhere, from geocaching all around Boston to outer space to the animal kingdom and even in a library like we are in today. So we all know reading is an adventure, and these authors remind us how to get lost in the adventure of a book. So in just a minute, you'll get a chance to hear each author talk about his or her book. Then save your questions, because after they're all done talking, we'll have time for questions and answers. And then at the end, the authors will be outside signing their books, and you can buy their books outside. You probably saw that already. So enjoy. I'll tell you a little bit about each author. I'll start out with Erin. This is Erin Dion. She is a Red Sox fan. Are there other Red Sox fans?
Oh, yeah.
This guy's from New York, just to tell you, okay? So who here has been to Fenway Park? Who here has been to Fenway Park by themselves at night after the game is over? Anyone? No, does that sound fun or a little creepy? I think it sounds a little fun. All right. The kids in Erin's book, which is called Moxie and the Art of Rule Breaking, are go on adventures all around Boston. Moxie is the main character. Her grandfather did a little bit of shady stuff. And to make a long story short, Moxie ends up going all around Boston trying to retrieve the stolen Isabella Stewart Gardner paintings. Do you guys know about that story? That artwork was stolen? Okay, Erin will tell you. So that's what the kids end up doing. They end up in Fenway Park after dark. They end up at the State House. They go on adventures all over town. Erin's other books include Models Don't Eat Chocolate Cookies, Notes from an Accidental Band Geek, and The Total Tragedy of a Girl Named Hamlet. Her main characters are spunky girls, and Moxie fits right in. And Erin will tell you all about her book.
So, first of all, I'm so excited to be here today with all of you. And I want to thank Alyssa and thank the organizers of the Boston Book Fest. This is an incredible day for people who love books and people who love reading and people who love stories. And I'm just so grateful to be a part of it. And I'm super excited to be on a panel with all these really cool authors. I want to tell you a little bit about Moxie and her story. This is my fourth book, but it's a book that I've been thinking about writing for about 6 or 7 years. And that's because I've been fascinated by the Gardner heist. Ever since I came to Boston, I came here for college, the paintings have been gone. And the story of the heist is late on March 18th, it was actually like just after St. Patrick's Day, it was just after midnight, so early in the morning on March 18th, two thieves who were actually dressed as Boston police officers were able to trick the nighttime security guards at the Gardner Museum in the Fenway into opening the door and letting them in. And the thieves came in and they overpowered the security guards and they tied them up in the basement of the museum. And there was no time for them to trigger an alarm. So the thieves were alone in the museum for 84 minutes. And they went around and they stole 13 pieces of art, including several paintings by a really famous painter named Rembrandt, sketches by a painter named Degas, a little vase that is actually the oldest artifact in the museum, and a little like eagle that was on top of a flagpole that was used in a Napoleonic War. And so the way that they actually took the paintings was they took a knife and they cut the paintings out of the canvases and ripped them off the wall, leaving the frames hanging on the wall. So the frames are empty. And the theft wasn't discovered until the next morning when they came in to open the museum and they found the guards in the basement. And the art has been missing ever since. So it's been 23 years that it's been gone. It's worth $500 million. The FBI is still investigating it, and there's a $5 million reward for the return of the paintings in good condition. So, but when you go to the Gardner Museum, the thing that's so interesting to me is the frames are still hanging on the wall because of the way that the museum is set up. The museum actually isn't allowed to take the empty frames off the wall. So when you go there, you can see these empty frames with pieces of the canvas hanging down. And that really sparked my imagination. And I thought about that theft for years and years until I found the character that I wanted to tell my story. And her name is Moxie. And she lives in Jamaica Plain. Her grandfather has Alzheimer's, but he used to be a carpenter in the city of Boston. And he used to be a carpenter for some pretty shady characters. Like if you were a thief and you needed a hidey hole in your house to maybe hide some stolen stuff, he would come in and build a secret cubby for you. So Moxie finds out that her grandfather may have been involved in the Gardner heist. And she and her best friend Oliver start scouring the city to see if they can find the paintings. So it was really fun to write, and it was the first time that I wrote an adventure mystery story, and I got to write a chase scene, and that was really cool.
So you'll be able to ask more questions after we've talked to everybody. Our next panelist is Chris Grabenstein.
Well said.
Thank you. Not Steen or Steen. He's written books for kids and adults. Most of his kids' books are very, very silly, but also really, really funny and really smart. He has co-authored books with James Patterson, who is an author you also may have heard of. A series, the iFunny series, which is appropriate for a guy who used to be an improv comedian. Maybe he'll do a routine for us later. He's also a playwright and a screenwriter, and he's also written some creepy stories for adults, yes?
I write murder mysteries for adults, but I've written ghost stories for little kids. Yeah.
His latest book is called Escape from Mr. Limoncello's Library, and the way I think of it is part Willy Wonka, part Westing Game, if you know those books. There's lots of wordplay, there are rebus puzzles, and there are lots of references to other children's books and lots of very silly puns and wordplay and jokes. It's about a boy named Kyle who loves games and contests, and he enters a contest that's put together by his favorite game maker to try to escape from a library. And it's a whole lot of fun.
Well, thank you. Yeah, are any librarians here? First of all, thank you. But second of all, the story in this book will break your heart because I made up a town. I called it Alexandriaville, Ohio, based on the Library of Alexandria, where they bulldozed down the public library 12 years ago because they needed to put up a cement parking garage. But fortunately, Luigi Limoncello grew up. His parents were Italian immigrants. They had like 12 kids at home. And the only place he could get any peace and quiet was at the public library. And the public librarian sort of took him under his wing, and he developed all of his first games right there in the library. She would pull things out of her drawers like thimbles and a pink Barbie boot, and he would make those into the game pieces of his games. And by the time he was 18, he was a millionaire. When this story opens, he's a bazillionaire. And a bazillion dollars is a lot more than $1 million. So he's a bazillionaire, and he decides this town needs a library. And so he spends $500 million to make the most incredible library ever invented, and it's a three-story tall building with a dome, and there's hover ladders. If you want a book, you just put in the code of the book you want, put your feet into these ski boots, and the platform will float you right up to your book. And there's holograms walking around, there's a tiger that's on the loose, there's some geese in the children's book that are animatronics by Disney World. They will sing along to any book you are reading, including Walter the Farting Dog. So this place has got all this incredible stuff in it. And to celebrate the grand opening, Mr. Limoncello says, you 12-year-olds have been without a library your whole life. So 12 of you are invited to be the first ones in. We have a big library lock-in, lock the door. You'll get to spend the night. They get to go to the game room. They get to go to the IMAX theater. They get to watch old, I think, Mozart plays with Metallica. They get to see all just all this kind of cool stuff. They stay up till 3 o'clock in the morning. They have a wonderful time. They wake up the next day, and the door is still locked. And Mr. Limoncello says, who would like to play a new game? And the object of this game is to find your way out of the library only using things inside the library. So it begins this great series of clues and puzzles. And what really happens is some of the kids learn that sometimes you can do things better as a team. But there's one kid, Charles Chiltington, he's rather win it all for himself. So he's the bad guy. Don't root for Charles. So that it goes on, and that what's fun is you get to play along. There's Rebus puzzles for you to solve. And since you're all here, I will give you an extra hint. There is one puzzle that's in the book that's not in the story. And if you figure it out, you can send me an email. And everyone who gets it right, we're putting their names into a drawing that we have on January 1st. And you'll get two complete libraries of every book I've ever written for kids. Plus, my editors at Random House are going around grabbing two copies of every book they can. I got three crates of boxes in my house already. And we're going to send two complete libraries to whoever is the lucky winner. One for your personal library and one for you to donate to your favorite school or public library. So here is a clue that will help you find the hidden puzzle. Mr. Limoncello's first and worst idea might be your best solution. That's all I'm going to say.
All right. Mysterious. So our third author is Wendy Mass. I'm sorry. Wendy has written a lot of different types of books for kids. She has written some series, fairy tale takeoff series called Twice Upon a Time. She's written the Willow Fall series. She's written Jeremy Fink and the Meaning of Life, A Mango-Shaped Space, Every Soul a Star, and The Candy Makers. And her latest book is called Pie in the Sky, and it's a sci-fi adventure. It takes place sort of in outer space, although it's not exactly outer space. Maybe you can clarify that a little bit. And it's set in a place called The Realms, and it stars a kid who's an alien, sort of, but very complicated. But his name is Joss, and he's the seventh son of the supreme overlord of the universe. And his task is to recreate Earth because the powers that be of his society sort of blink it out of existence. Luckily, a girl named Annika comes from Earth to help him out. And there are a lot of very silly parts to this book. But it's also quite poignant, and there's actually even some real science. And Carl Sagan, who is an astronomer, makes a cameo appearance.
Wow, that just sounds crazy. That was like the craziest story. Yeah, what she said. I do have a hard time describing this book, and really, I mean, I love writing about science. I've written about it in many of my other books, and I can't seem to let it go. And really, that's the big secret of that writers keep to themselves, is that they write about what they're interested in. And, you know, I'm fascinated by science, so I knew that if I was going to put it in my books to get young readers excited about it, I needed to do a ton of research. So I did. I've done so much research over the years that I could probably teach, like, physics 101 right now. But my goal with this book really was, you know, to tell a fun adventure of these two kids trying to recreate the planet Earth exactly how it was originally created, but, you know, or at least as science tells us that. But really, it was to kind of use real science as a way to guide you through the story. So, like, each chapter begins with a quote from a real scientist, and then you might not, you know, like the young readers especially, might not understand what that quote means until they've read the chapter. And so the fiction kind of relies on the real science, if that kind of makes sense. And the idea for this book came from a group of 12-year-olds. I was doing a school visit and talking to kids about reading, and before I came, they had read a bunch of my books, and they put together this sort of notebook full of different quotes that they thought I would like. And one of them was a quote by Carl Sagan that went, if you wish to make an apple pie, you must first create the universe. Or you must first invent the universe. And I loved that. And by the time I got home from the trip, which was only like an hour drive, I had the first line of the book, which says, let's see, if you think it's tough being the supreme overlord of the universe, try being his son, or more precisely, his seventh son. And then it kind of goes from there. And that just sort of set the tone for me that it was going to be this boy who is the son of the overlord of the universe, who lives inside dark matter, which is really what the stuff of the universe is created from, but we have no idea what it is. But most of the universe is created of stuff that we don't know and we can't see. And I just find that fascinating. So I decided to set a whole civilization inside this dark matter stuff, because why not? Who's to say it's not there? So that's where the realms is. And so he's really like 14 billion years old. He's the age of the universe, but he still has to go to seventh grade and he's getting really tired of it. And so he kind of needed some adventure in his life. So by making the earth disappear, and he was assigned to help fix it, it really set him on his path. And hopefully would get readers excited about science. That was my goal.
Our fourth author is Catherine Lasky, and she's written a lot of books. Lots and lots of different kinds of books. Over 100 books. Wow. She has written middle grade novels, young adult novels. She's written picture books. She's written nonfiction. She's written some adult books. She's written about mermaids, owls, wolves, spiders, princesses, American girls, and many, many other topics. Some of her series include The Deadlies, Daughters of the Sea, Wolves of Beyond, and The Guardians of Gahul. And some of you may have seen the movie that that is based on her books, called Legend of the Guardian. Her newest book is The Rise of a Legend, and it's sort of a prequel to the Guardians of Gahul series. It's about war and peace and owls, is the way that I sort of try to sum it up. And it's a true animal adventure story. It brings you really into this fully formed world of these creatures. And if animal adventures are your thing, even if they aren't, you'll really love these books. So.
First, I think it's kind of odd that I'm the only author who forgot to bring her own book. So just picture this owl, and he's got his wings going up like that. But you can buy it out there. But oh how pretty. It's so pretty. I don't know. I didn't see it. Okay, here it is. You mean you guys didn't remember to bring one? They gave
no,
you one?
No, I brought one.
Oh, you brought one.
I think the most important thing I can tell you about this book is the idea came from a boy who had been reading my book since he was 9 years old. He read all 15 of these owl books, and he said, aren't you ever going to do another owl book? I really thought I was finished. And he said, I have an idea for you. I think you need to do something about Easelrib, who is the sage of the great Gahul tree. And he was a very interesting character, but I never really talked that much about him. I mean, he said, why don't you tell us, what was his childhood like? We know he was hatched out in the northern kingdoms, but how did he become this genius? And why was he hiding his whole life as a warrior before people found out, or owls found out about it? So I thought, well, that is a good idea. And I just, so I began the owl book actually with, if you will recall, in the very first owl book, Soren and the band show up at the great Gahul tree. And owls don't know where they came from or anything, but something catches Easelrib's attention about Soren. So the book begins with a deep flashback about the night when that band showed up. And then the first chapter goes on to Easelrib deciding to write his life story, inspired by seeing these young owls. So it goes on into how he became a warrior. It was a time of great strife. His parents, he was always being left to be owlsat, as they called it when he was a chick, or I called by nestmate snakes, if you remember them. And then he suffers a great loss, but he goes to military school and learns how to become this incredible fighter, and he's ingenious. He's a scientist. He decides to employ snakes in warfare. They ride on the backs of owls and all of that. And I don't want to give away the whole story, but I think I write so much about animals, and the one thing that always surprises people is that I don't particularly care for animals. And I kind of just shuddered every time my children wanted to get a pet. And it was all on them to take care of those animals. And but why do I write in the voice of an animal so many times? And I just feel it's very liberating in a way. But I have to learn as much as I can about that animal, because to get, you know, their habits, how they fly, or how wolves tear apart their prey. I know more about wolf teeth than you'd ever want to know. And if I know that much, I can then write with some confidence. I won't go as far as to say authority, but confidence. And hopefully I can get the reader to that willing state of suspension of disbelief. And then I can filter in actually quite a bit of human emotion. But I personally do not care for animals. And I live in dread of doing some, you know, performance someplace, and somebody comes in, and it has happened, and asks me to, you know, hold an animal. And I don't do very well. And sometimes I even say, please, no. And I lie and say, you know, I have allergies and stuff like that.
You're allergic to wolves and owls. All right, well, I have a few questions that I want to ask the authors, and then we'll get to questions that you guys have. My first question is, you have all written many different types of books. What for you is different about writing an adventure story than any of these other sorts of books that you write?
Well, I could answer that first. I think it depends on if a book is plot-driven or character-driven, and the adventure books start more with the plot for me. And the other ones, the more coming-of-age type of books, start more with the character. And, I mean, they still go on like an emotional adventure, but it's not the same. So, because when you're writing a book with an adventure, whether it's a mystery or you're certainly getting them from one place to another place, and you have to really, or at least I do anyway, really need to plot that out ahead of time. Whereas with the other books, it comes more organically.
I think so. When I write an adventure book or a mystery, I sort of write backwards. I have to know how these kids are going to find their way out of the library before I even get started. And then it becomes sort of a game that you play as a writer, is where you drop just enough clues that I want everybody to go back and go, oh, I should have seen that sooner. You know, I should have figured that out. And if you do that, then you do like a fair play kind of mystery where the reader gets to play along. And those are the books that I enjoy reading the most. And my favorite emails are the ones I get from kids who say, my parents don't know this, but I stayed up all night reading your book. I couldn't put it down. They still do that flashlight under the covers thing, don't you?
Yeah, for me, you know, I'm usually, I don't plan my books out, and I always start with a character and go forward from there. And I still did that with Moxie, but I did have to have those little pieces of structure along the way and know, you know, where she was going to go. So I did have to kind of impose a little bit more structure on my writing process to write an adventure story. And I also, the other thing that was different for me was I've always done research for my books, you know, for my humorous fiction, but I really felt a deep level to the research to get everything right about Boston, because I was writing about the city that I love. So I spent way too much time learning about the city and about how to be a really good art thief.
So if something else goes missing, we'll check it first.
From this library, maybe.
I'm trying to process what everybody said. I actually think I'm exactly the opposite of you. I'm very character-driven. That's what makes me want to write a book. And what's hard for me is the action scenes. I can kind of figure out the plot stuff, but I also have an editor who is addicted to action. And I said, basically, I think my editor is a 10-year-old boy. And there are certain scenes I write, action scenes, that I just, it's almost like I write them for her. It's always an adventure. I mean, I don't think there is any greater adventure than penetrating the human mind, and that means character. And I think my essential thing is not so much plot, but in the characters, I like characters who take risks. And that, I guess, is what the action and the plot grow out of. I like characters who are vulnerable. And I also think that's what engages a reader. I hate heroes. Yeah. I shouldn't say hate.
My 7-year-old says H word. I H word heroes. I'm not allowed to say
hate. I H word. H squared.
Yes, that would be good.
Erin, did you go on these adventures around Boston to write your book? Did you sneak into Fenway? Or were you in the state? Is that made up? Or is it how
I
much
can neither
of that
confirm
is
nor
real?
Deny. I did spend a lot of time in each place and doing as much, like I said, as much research as I could. I did not sneak into Fenway after dark. But I did a lot of, I'm very fortunate to have a friend whose brother worked inside the Green Monster at Fenway doing the manual scoreboard stuff. So I've seen pictures of what that looks like. And it smells really bad in there, especially in the summer. So I was able I tried to get as much firsthand information as I could. And there is, as far as I know, no storage room in the dome of the State House, but there's one in the basement that was just discovered.
What other sorts of adventures did you all go on, either writing these books or other books that you've written?
I went to the Natural History Museum at Harvard, which is two blocks from my house. Which is actually a pretty creepy place if anybody wants to set a book there. I love that museum because nothing's interactive. You touch anything, they come in and slap your hand, and dust rises in the place. It's really the way a museum should be.
Sorry, all I can think of is an adult murder mystery I wrote where I made the mistake of setting it in the men's room of a Garden State Parkway. That was some of the most exciting research I've ever done in my life. Going in there with a camera? No.
Well, I mean, to teach myself astronomy, I went to a lot of astronomy lectures and would sort of try to corner these like famous scientists, like sometimes world famous. Like if a physicist was giving a talk and he was here from England, I'd go to the university where he was talking and I would say, you know, if you were living inside dark matter, what elements would compose your body? And he'd be like, you can't live inside. I'm like, but if you could live inside dark matter, would it be hydrogen, helium, like the elements there at the beginning of the universe? And he's like, well, I suppose you could do that. So I felt like that was enough of a blessing. And I'm like, okay, I can check that one off. So I did bother a lot of very smart people for this book.
I had to bother a lot of librarians who helped me learn the Dewey Decimal System again.
Did you run any of your puns by anyone before you put them in the book?
Mr. Lemoncello has a habit of putting book titles into his speech. So I've started a new thing now. I meet authors whose books are in his speech. I get them to sign the book. So
pretty cool. Do you have any examples? I don't have any more.
Al Capone Does My Underwear. I met her. We did an event together in Atlanta, and I said that Mr. Limoncello says I showed a line that had her sign right on the page where her line was.
I guess my line's going to be in the sequel.
It's like,
yeah,
the
mine
sequel.
Too.
I'm never signing anything.
Book,
Fair enough. Do you all read adventure stories, or do you prefer to read other types of books?
When I'm writing adventure, I don't read it because you don't want to like be borrowing things from other authors. So when I'm not working on an adventure book, I love reading them still. Most of my fun reading I do is nonfiction, which is where you get just because fiction, nonfiction is sometimes more fun than fiction even.
I read really widely. When I am writing a book, I don't read the same type of book, just like what Chris said. But I read basically anything I can get my hands on because I feel like different types of writing teaches you how to tell a story in different ways. So whether it's fiction or nonfiction or adult or children's or picture books, I'll read it all.
I read very widely too, and I usually try to avoid reading books that are anywhere near what I'm trying to do. But I have to say, when I started the Wolf series, Wolves of the Beyond, I thought, this is a great excuse to read Jack London again. I just loved Jack London as a kid. So I reread White Fang, and oh boy, and my book is nothing like White Fang. But boy, is that a good book.
I think, like what Chris said about nonfiction, I mean, we read nonfiction to get ideas for fiction. Mm-hmm. So I do that a lot, and a lot of my books come from that source. And so I, too, try not to read too many books exactly like what I'm writing. So, like, for instance, I'm working on a book on geocaching, and I'm kind of glad that I didn't know about Erin's book beforehand because it might have stopped me from doing it. And, you know, everybody's books are so different, even if you're writing about the same thing, but it's hard to remember that at the time. Like, I could have just said, okay, there's a book like that, I'm not going to do it. Whereas otherwise, you know, books on the similar topics help feed each other, and they feed the reader's, you know, interest in that. So,
do either of you geocache? Have you done?
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
I do now.
Yeah, and then the good thing is, if you're writing about it, it becomes a tax write-off.
Yes. Yeah.
Your geocaching adventures, like the book that I'm probably going to be writing is a sequel to a book that I wrote called The Candy Makers. And so I proposed to my editor that it be called The Candy Makers Go Geocaching in a Tricked Out RV. So that, like, I rented an RV last month to go geocaching and figured, can I write off this whole RV trip? And then she crossed out that line and she's like, how about just The Candy Makers Go Geocaching or Go Treasure Hunting? I'm not sure. I'm like, but I need my RV back in there. So,
can you just explain really quickly what geocaching is, if people don't know?
I'm going to hand that to you, because it's in your book. So,
Moxie's best friend, Oliver, is a rabid geocacher, and it's urban treasure hunting. You can go on these websites, and people have hidden, sometimes it's canisters with little, like, cool little knickknacks. Sometimes it's just a container that has a notebook in it. And you get coordinates, like GPS coordinates, or sometimes you get clues. And you use a handheld GPS or a smartphone to enter the coordinates, and you try and find this hidden object. And there are bunches of them all over Boston. There are some in the public garden. There are some hidden in churches. And when you get the GPS coordinates, you track down, and the coordinates might lead you to this room, and then you actually have to go searching for the container that holds your little trinket. Or if it's a notebook, usually you sign saying that you found the cache. And Ollie both likes to hunt for geocache containers and leave his own. So those, and the skills that he has help Moxie look for the art.
I think the best way that I've heard it, and that was a great description, the best way that I heard it summed up in one line is, you use billions of dollars worth of high-tech satellite equipment to find Tupperware hidden in the woods.
Yes.
So that's exactly what it is in a nutshell.
All right, well, I have lots more questions, but let's see what questions you guys have. There's a microphone that is going to go around.
Don't be shy.
Don't be shy.
Well, let me ask you guys, while we're waiting for people to think of questions, what are some of the most interesting or strangest questions that people have asked you from the audience?
I get asked a lot about, and this is kind of hard for me to answer. They say, did you have a really good library when you grew up? Because the books are really a great celebration of librarians. And I have to explain that. I say, no, I grew up in Tennessee. We didn't have us no libraries. And my school I went to, we didn't have a very good library. And when I first started visiting schools, kids would say, what books did you read when you were a kid? And I'd say, Mad Magazine. So that's all I can remember from age 10. I asked my mother. And I had not read a lot of the books that kids now read. And recently I started my own remedial reading program where I go back and I'm reading all the books I should have read. And Bud Not Buddy's my new favorite book. Oh. And I got to meet Christopher Paul Curtis a couple of weeks ago, so that was like really cool. And but now that I go to school, I go and I usually have to wait in the library like 7 o'clock in the morning, and I'm there and there are all these great media specialists, they call them now, they don't even call them librarians, are there, and these kids are coming in with books and said, I just love this Rick Riordan, and oh, if you love that, you're gonna love this Wendy Mass, and they're handing out books like crazy, and I'm going, where were these people when I was there? So that's the question I get asked. I always hate to answer. I grew up in Tennessee. There's a question down there now.
For the library thingy book, what's it called?
That was the first title, was the library thingy book. The editor didn't like that.
No, I like that. How long did it take you to make the book?
Ah, it's a very good question. I'm a very fast writer because I worked with James Patterson in advertising for years, so I can usually write my books the first draft in 4 months. But this book, because it had the word library in the title, we knew that every librarian in America might look at it. So we worked 2 years on this book, and I rewrote 50% of it 7 different times. So this is I've worked longer on this book than any book in my life. And we just get ready to publish it, and I enter, go, you know, one more thing I've been thinking about. And the book had a bad title at my house for a long time. But it took 2 years to write this book.
And what inspired you to make some of the games inside the library?
Oh, the games inside the library started. I have 4 brothers, 2 of whom are older than me and 2 who are younger. But the 2 who are older than me, one was a genius. You know, he's like 99 percentile on his, so I come home with like a 98, like, just got a 99, who cares? And my other brother, Tom, but I knew when we played Monopoly or Risk, because that's what we used to do is play games all the time, that I could beat them. So the whole idea for the character in the book came out of that part of myself that remembered what it was like when you played board games, you finally had a chance to beat your older brothers.
Do you expect on making any of the games in your story?
That's a good question. I actually had a librarian design a game so libraries everywhere could play the same kind of game.
Oh, great.
So
that's awesome.
That's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. So libraries all over America are playing this kind of scavenger hunt game inside their library.
That's very cool. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, there's some points.
Library thing.
My question is for Wendy Mass. I wanted to know how you thought of connecting everything in the Willow Falls series.
The Willow Falls series is a book that started with 11 birthdays, and then 13 gifts, and the last present, which just came out last week. And you know, when that series started, I had a contract for 2 books, 11 birthdays and Finally. And they were both just separate, 2 separate books. And I finished 11 birthdays, and when I started writing Finally, which is about a girl who's been keeping track of all the things she can do when she turns 12, like the things her parents said she could do, I suddenly, you know, called my editor and said, is there any reason we can't set this in the same town as the other book? I mean, it's different kids, but what if we had some of the other kids from this book come into this book? And she's like, well, you know, why don't you do that a little bit, but then if at the end we decide not to, we'll pull them out. And then she just kind of forgot. So they stayed. And then, I, you know, proposed a contract for 2 more books in the series. And at that point, I was kind of committed to making it a series, but even still, we still call it like a series in quotes because it's still not really a series. Like each book can really stand on its own, except for kind of the last one. You kind of need to read the one before it. But I had a lot of fun kind of visiting these kids. Each year they get older, so each year revolves around a birthday. So the characters are 11 and 11 birthdays, and then you see them again at you know, 13 and a half in the last book. And that's such a big time in your life, you know, 11 to 13, you change so much. So I loved sort of maturing them and trying to put the pieces of the puzzles all together and how it all links together. And it was hard, but I did a lot of like mapping out, like physically with post-it notes and moving things around. And like, do you guys do that? Do you,
yeah.
Do, you do that? Mm-hmm. And that's really helpful to be able to like visualize it. And sometimes like a reader will catch something. Like I'd give them to like some 12-year-olds who'd read the whole series. And I'm, you know, here's a rough draft of the last one. I'm like, well, you never explained how this person met that person in book two. Maybe you could put it in here. And I'm like, perfect. And then I even just opened up on my website, I have a blog, and I said, you know, anyone who's read the other books, if there's things that you want to see in The Last Present, which is going to be the last book, probably, you know, let me know. And they just filled pages of, you know, I want to see how this character learned this, and how did, what happened to this person. And so it was really a really collaborative effort.
Catherine, can you talk about that too?
Sorry.
Hi. Wendy Mass, I have a question for you.
Oh, hi, sweetie.
So how did you get the inspiration for A Mango-Shaped Space? Because that's one of my favorite books by you.
Thank you. A Mango-Shaped Space was my first book, and it's about a girl who has synesthesia, which is where your senses are kind of cross-wired in your brain. And that came from reading a nonfiction book on the subject. I was walking through my local public library at the time. I think it was in like Westport, Connecticut, and this book literally fell off the shelf. And really, like, I walked by, I'm not kidding, like, I walked by and must have knocked it off or something, and I used to be a library aide in sixth grade, and you couldn't possibly, like, leave a library book out of the right, you know, I had to go back in the exact right place. So I just looked at it, and it was called The Man Who Tasted Shapes, and I thought, how can you taste a shape? That's really weird. And then just standing there in the aisle and looking at it made me think, you know, the man in the book had synesthesia, and it was like a memoir. And I started thinking, I'd never seen this in fiction before, and how would it be to feel like you perceive the world differently than everybody? And that's where it came from.
Thank you.
This guy's getting a workout here.
Now he's running. Look at him go.
What made you decide you wanted to write middle grade fiction, or did it just sort of come about because that's who the audience for the story would be?
I actually had a very funny experience. I was writing adult mysteries at the time, adult mysteries and thrillers, and I wrote a 120,000 word ghost story for adults. And they said, well, his name's not Stephen King, we're not going to publish this. But somebody read this and said, you know, this would be a good middle grade ghost story. You get rid of some of the gore and the blood and you cut 70,000 words out of it. And my agent said, you really want to do that? I said, yeah, it'd be fun. Because I have like 20 nieces and nephews who couldn't read my adult mysteries and things, so I wanted to have something they could read. And then when I wrote it, it must have been all those years of Mad Magazine warping my mind. They said, boy, you really have a good middle grade voice. And now, let's be honest, you kids, you read more than your parents, don't you? Come on, yeah, they're nodding. So I like writing for kids better. I don't know about your other.
What about you? Is your range, like you have so many different
Well, things. I didn't write that much middle grade until I started the OWL books. And I wasn't sure whether I could do it until I sat down to do it. And then I thought, oh, basically, I've never advanced since sixth grade. I am an eternal 11-year-old. So it felt really natural to me, and I liked it better than some of the angst you have to work through with young adult stuff. And I still like doing the young adult stuff, but I'm really, this just feels like putting on really comfortable bedroom slippers to write for middle grade. I love it.
Yeah, for me, I just, I think writers have certain things that resonate with them, and for me, it's those junior high years. I think I finally as an adult kind of have a handle on them, and I'm excited about the story. I don't have a handle on adulthood at all, but I got a handle on junior high, and I want to tell those stories. I think it's a really exciting time, and the voice of kids that age, just it's so comfortable for me. It's so easy for me, and I'm really grateful because I think those are the most invested readers out there.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the books that we read at this time in our life, from like third grade to eighth grade, you know, they have a certain power and magic to them, and they live on inside us. At least that's how it was for me when I was in those years. And so really, I never thought of writing anything else. I knew I was going to write for that genre, and I've never, you know, strayed too much from that, just to kind of, I don't know, feel like a part of the books that meant so much to me growing up.
Hi, my question is for Ms. Lasky. How much input did you have for your movie, The Legend of the Guardians? Mm-hmm. Were you consulted heavily on that, or did they have a lot of free rein just from reading your books? Or?
Well, they consulted me. they did not necessarily do what I said. I didn't have a lot of power, but they made me feel pretty close to the project in a lot of ways, which was nice. But, you know, I didn't have the final decision on anything. The one thing I'm really pleased with, they really listened to me, and I would have liked to have seen this one. Odalisa, who happens to be my favorite character, I think, in the whole series, was in the initial screenplay, not in it at all. And I talked with the producer, and I said, Lionel Wigram, and he had come to New York, and I met him there. And I said, I think it's a big mistake to leave her out. She doesn't have to have a major role, but she's got to be included, because you don't know the fan mail I get about her. And she's a pretty complex character, and I said, don't worry, you don't have to, you know, get into all of her hang-ups and all that, but she has to be included in some way. And they did. And I felt that was really a great achievement. But I have to tell you, a book's not a movie. Movie's not a book. They can't come out the same way. The book, it goes on in your mind. It has, you're in the, when you, I'm writing it, I'm in the mind of those characters. In a movie, it all has to be visual and has to communicate immediately to the audience. So a movie can never be as character-driven as a book. And as I said earlier, I'm a very character-driven writer. And that's just not what movies are made for, especially it's an action movie. Yeah, so, but it was a very nice experience working with him. I'm really excited because in January I'm going to Australia, where the animation studios are, and I'm going to meet up with those guys again, who were geniuses. And I do think it's the most beautiful movie I have ever seen, most beautiful animated movie.
My question for Wendy Mass. First off, you're one of my grades in my school's like favorite authors.
Thank you. Thank you, grade in her school.
And I'm in the middle of one of my favorite books by you, The Candy Makers. Now, why did you want to write the sequel about geo hunting instead of writing a whole nother book?
So The Candy Makers is about four kids competing to make the world's best new candy. And it's like almost 500 pages.
Yeah.
And here's a secret that I'll only tell you guys. But I actually wrote the whole book, handed it into my editor, 500 pages, like a year and a half of my life. And she said, well, what if you stopped at page 20 and then threw out the whole rest of the book and started over? And I'm like, oh my God, no. And so I did. And so I've really written that book completely two different books twice. So I never really wanted to do anything else with that book. And then when I said, yeah, you know, I loved the characters and it was fun to put together and I got to eat a ton of candy while researching the book. So that was great. But when I proposed the idea of a book on geocaching to my editor, she said, how about the candy makers that could be in, you know, they could be the ones going on this geocaching adventure. And in a way, that gets me out of the candy factory where I feel like I've exhausted the story already, and it gets them out into their RV and around the country. So that's why.
I have a question for Miss Lasky. How did you come up with the names for the Owl Kingdoms?
Oh, the names for the Owl Kingdom or the various owls in that kingdom?
The kingdoms.
The kingdom. Well, I just started kind of tossing around syllables in my head. And I always really, although I don't think of myself as musical, I'm very attentive to the phrasing and music of a sentence and the symmetry of a sentence and all that. So I have this sort of sound life going in my head. And I just sort of was tossing these syllables around. I thought, ga, ga, or something. And then hool just seemed to come out of it somehow. And it could have been, the French word for owl is hool, I'm not, H-O-U-L-E. So I think that came into it a little bit too. I keep a lot of weird dictionaries around, and sometimes I just flip through them. So I have like the Dictionary of Lost Words, which is really a cool dictionary. And then I have a Norwegian dictionary and a Yiddish one. And so I just sort of go through and kind of take a fragment of this word and a fragment of that and slam them together. And that's what I did. Not a very coherent explanation.
Time for one more question.
There's a hand right over here.
Oh.
What were your favorite books as kids, and how did they change what you write about today?
Oh, that's a great question.
I loved adventure stories when I was a kid, you know, like, and mysteries. I read a ton of Nancy Drew, I read the Great Brain books, I read The Westing Game, and I've written three other books, and they're funny books, and I was afraid to write an adventure story because I loved them so much when I was a kid. I was afraid I would do it wrong as a writer. So it took me a long time to get up the courage to actually write like one of those books, because they were so important to me when I was young.
Wow, I'm going back to Tennessee now.
Tennessee has
mine
changed.
Mine was Don Martin Drops 13 Stories, which is one of the mad books I collected. But I remember the books I read more in high school, because I went to a really good high school, and I, you know, read *To Kill a Mockingbird*. I fell in love with Shakespeare, like as a freshman in school. And I did a lot of plays when I was like your age, and then high school and college. And that's a neat way, as a writer, you get to play all the different parts in your book. So it's like, don't talk to me. I'm in here being the bad guy right now. And so to me, that was like a great experience, just to be acting plays and do dialogue and that kind of stuff.
I was a big fan of the Judy Blume books, and Harriet the Spy was a big favorite of mine, and probably inspired my love of writing, really, seeing, you know, a young girl carrying a notebook with her because she wanted to be a writer, and got my own notebook based on Harriet's. And my mom used to, like, I remember once we were in the supermarket and I sort of strayed a little bit, and so just to be mean over the loudspeaker, I hear Harriet Mass, come to the front desk, Harriet Mass. I'm like, oh my God. So you slink over there. Those books, and the Chronicles of Narnia. I was a huge Narnia fan, and Edward Eger's books.
Brilliant. Yeah.
And although I just got the audiobook for Half Magic, and I'm listening to it with my 7-year-old, and like suddenly there's some parts that aren't as, I don't know. I wish I could just fast forward over. And then it felt a little out of place.
So
it was more like violent. Suddenly, out of nowhere, they're like dismembering some knights, and they come back together, if that helps. But that, and one book that I read in 7th grade that I always try to get people to read, it's called Allegra Maud Goldman. Has anybody read that book? No. No one ever has read this book. Although I did meet Karen Cushman, you know, Newbery Medal winner for Midwife's Apprentice, and it's her favorite book, so I felt a little bit more normal. Allegra Maud Goldman, find it.
I'm trying to think. To Kill a Mockingbird was really important to me. And I'm old. So, like, children's books, when I was your guys, they weren't quite the same. I mean, Judy Blume was still probably, you know, she was maybe in high school when I was in sixth grade. So she didn't really, Lois Lowry, same thing. And then there was this great era that started happening in the 70s, I guess, where you got these Harry, and by that time I was, you know, in college or beyond. So I often read what my parents were reading. And one of the great moments of my life, I read The Naked and the Dead by Norman Mailer when I was in the seventh grade. And, well, because it was around. My parents had read it. I read it. And I got to meet Norman Mailer once. And the person I was with said, and by the way, Catherine read your book when she was in the seventh grade. And he looked up. He was very old at the time. He said, oh, you must have been in therapy ever since. What's wrong with your parents? So I just really read what my parents... I did love the Oz books, I have to say. And I read them over and over again.
All right. Well, thank you very much, authors. Thank you guys for your great questions.
Thanks, guys. Yeah.